New Horizon has been serving the church in Northern Ireland since 1989, and we're delighted to bring you this talk today. We trust you will be blessed through this ministry.
Thanks, Rachel. So yes, I'm Johnny, and this is also Johnny. I am the Johnny that works as part of the national team in Youth for Christ, and this Johnny is the Johnny that works in Craigavon, managing the centre and the project there. Thank you so much for coming to our seminar. You'll get to know a little bit more about Johnny later on, and maybe not get to know as much about me, but I'm on the stand all week, so feel free to come and have a chat with me. There's two things, though, that I want to tell you that I think are happening to me as I'm getting older, okay? You may be looking going, he's not very old. Good job, yeah. But there's two things I think are happening. One is I think I know what's going on as I look around me. And the other thing that I think is happening is that I'm aware that there's always more to the story. Those two things. I think I know what's going on, and there's always more to the story. But you see, the thing about those two things is they're kind of contradictory sometimes. They don't necessarily fit well. As I sort of look around and think, I understand what's going on in that situation. But then actually you realize there's more going on there than maybe I'm aware of. If you don't know what I mean, come with me a wee second. I'm thinking about those environments whenever maybe you see somebody coming into church. Maybe you see an unmarried couple coming into church with a toddler. And you maybe start to think, do I know what's going on in that situation? Maybe you're driving past somebody's house and it looks very disheveled from the outside, but yet you can see a nice car, you see a big TV inside the window, and maybe you start to think, do I know what's going on in that situation? Maybe you see the mum who's bringing her kids to church by herself. Do you start to think, I understand what's going on in that situation? You see, I do that. I make perceptions. But in the job that I get to do, I get to see that actually there's often more to the story. And I think we do it whenever we read the Bible too. Give me a wee show of hands. Who's familiar with the story in John's Gospel whenever Jesus is meeting with the woman at the well? Just a wee show of hands if you're familiar with the story. Brilliant. Okay, what I want you to do for 30 seconds, okay, is just with the person or two people beside you, is just to give a couple of the things that you remember from the story. So you go, one person says one thing, and then the other person says something else. Just what you remember from the story, where it was, what time it happened, what went on. 30 seconds, go, okay? Okay. Wrap that up. 30 seconds is a short time. Okay, so part of me would love to have sort of played like a Family Fortune sort of style event and get the top five answers, but we'll not be able to do that this morning. But just give me a wee nod or a wee raise of your hand if anybody talked about being midday, time of day. Okay, did you talk about Jesus asking her for a drink? Yeah. Did we talk about her saying, hang on, I'm a Samaritan, you're a Jew? Yeah. Did you talk about that Jesus told her that she'd had five husbands? Yeah. Okay. So we know the story pretty well. That's the wee bit that I just want us to focus on for a wee second, because part of the story that we get introduced to this woman is a wee bit. Okay. Part of the story that we get introduced to this woman is that she had five husbands and she was living with somebody who wasn't her husband. I think we read that and we go, oh, she's living with somebody who's not her husband. I wonder what else she did wrong. I wonder why she had five husbands. Maybe you read it like that. Maybe you read it the same way I do. It has been used as the story of the immoral Samaritan woman who realizes who Jesus is. But I reckon there's more to her story. So let's have a wee think about it. So, gotta love technology. So this woman, right, she's been divorced five times, or she's had five different husbands by one way or the other. But actually, she couldn't divorce her husband. It was her husband that would have had to divorce her. And he could divorce her for almost any reason. In their culture, if she found no favor in his eyes, she could be divorced. But actually, the teaching at the time that went with that included that actually she could have burnt or oversalted his dinner and she could have found herself divorced. It's humorous for us, but actually this is the rabbinic teaching of that time. He could have divorced her simply because he no longer found her attractive or he found somebody else that he wanted to marry. I don't know if whenever we read this that we actually necessarily think of what this woman might have experienced whenever she found herself in a situation encountering Jesus, having had five husbands and now living with somebody else. She could also have been widowed. Wouldn't have been uncommon for men to have died and to have left their wife widowed. But she would have been then reliant on men in that culture. She would have been needing to find another, somebody else to look after and to provide for her. She could have turned to prostitution. She clearly, in this situation, hasn't been told that she's done that. But she did have choices. She could have made it. The other thing that could have happened is that she could have been barren. She could have been unable to have children. And in part of that culture, that would have been a reason that women would have been divorced, because men would have wanted to be able to carry on the line. We're not given a divorced, beheaded, died sort of system story as to why this woman had ended up with five husbands and living with someone who wasn't her husband. But actually, it's probably quite likely that it wasn't her fault. It's quite likely that it was a combination of some of those things. And she's probably quite a marginalized woman. Woman who has experienced that, who's experienced being rejected by her husband, experienced being rejected potentially by a number of men, being rejected by society as part of that because of the image that that would have given her. I think there's more to her story. And Johnny and I think there's more to the story of the people who are marginalized here in Northern Ireland now. We want to make sure that we're on the same page, though, whenever we talk about marginalization, because you and I might have a slightly different picture of what we mean by those people who are marginalized. And we're talking about those people who are rejected, those people who feel outcast, those people who feel vulnerable, who don't feel included in what is going on in society around them, maybe people who don't have a voice. And those are the people that we see around us in Northern Ireland in various communities who don't have the same access to all the things that we do. So what does it mean for us to do mission to those people? That's we're thinking about this morning. Johnny and I, we work for Youth for Christ, and our centres are working in places where we are seeing young people, seeing families, seeing communities, where they're experiencing a fair amount of marginalisation. If you've seen The Sand, we are talking about a number of different poverties, various levels of disadvantage. Sorry if I need to move so you can see it. Economic poverty, educational poverty, cultural poverty, health and well-being poverty, and relational poverty. Different areas in life where people are experiencing disadvantage. And one of our youth workers has called it a vicious circle of disadvantage, where we see these young people, we see these families experiencing lots of these factors in their lives. And it's not that it happens in one particular area. It spills out. It impacts the different areas around it. Maybe you're thinking of people that you know, you're thinking of situations that you know where you've seen these levels of disadvantage. Maybe it's closer to home for some of you. One of the ways that we have been able recently to understand this a little bit better is through what are called ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. Because for Johnny and I, some of this is just the people that we know and what they're going through. But actually being able to talk about it in these terms as adverse childhood experiences has helped us understand it even better. And there's three main categories. There's abuse, neglect, and household dysfunction. Of things that are happening in young people's lives that are affecting them as they grow up. And one of the things that I have found the most startling, the most shocking, is the impact that this can have on young people as they grow up. So this is taken from a Welsh study, and whenever we were getting trained as our team here in Northern Ireland, they were able to show us the similarities between Welsh culture and a Northern Irish culture to say that actually there's a lot of similarities here. We don't have the data, but this is what they would predict is happening in Northern Ireland. And I don't know if you can read it. Let me just read it for us. So for people who have experienced four or more adverse childhood experiences compared with those who have none, They're twice as likely to experience chronic disease, twice as likely to experience lung disease, three times more likely to have a coronary heart disease, six times more likely to experience mental illness, six times more likely to take up smoking, 11 times more likely to use cannabis, 11 times more likely to be incarcerated. I've copied that slightly wrong. It's 11, and I think it is, I'll have to check, it's slightly lower than 11 for being a victim, okay? But the picture is there that these people who experience adverse childhood experiences as they grow up, levels of abuse, levels of neglect, and levels of household dysfunction, actually that's the reality of what it could look like for them growing up. There's more to their story. How quickly are we to look at the culture around us and see people who are making certain decisions and think, I don't know why they're making those decisions, I don't know why their life looks like that. But yet, has this path certainly been laid out for them? Are they more likely to be experiencing these things because of the communities that they're part of, the families that they have grown up in? For Johnny and I, we see that there's more to the story, and Johnny's going to tell you a little bit more now.
I usually break things, so this is going to be fun. There we go. Right, so it's really easy to be taken back by some of the statistics, but I want to share just a wee story about my time in Caergavon. So I help lead a church in Caergavon as well as work for Youth for Christ. And we also live there. So my hometown, my mission field, where I work is my life. And I'm proud of that. And it's also easier and petrol too, which is handy. And so back in 2019, I got a referral from the police, says, we've got this guy for you who just needs a positive voice in his life. Me as a youth worker thought this guy must be between 16, 20. And then he told me he was in his mid-30s, and I sort of gasped, and I was like, I don't know, I think you've maybe got the wrong man for the job. But the guy who rang me from the police was a Christian sergeant. He goes, no, I want you to meet him. And so with reluctancy, I know what's going to happen, hang on. With reluctancy, I said yes. And so it just started with a weekly coffee, right? So I used to meet him in Sainsbury's, in the old Sainsbury's in Caergavon. And we used to get a coffee. And during this time, he shared his story with me. And it was heartbreaking. He came from a life of drug addiction. He was addicted to drugs for 20 years. If my voice drops off, just let me know, right? He was addicted to drugs for 20 years. He was involved in organized crime since he was 14, okay? So he was stealing cars, drug dealing, were just two of his main crimes that he committed amongst many others. And so in front of me, I have not just an addict, right, but a criminal. And so this guy, people like him are responsible for the way Caergavon is the way it is today, if that makes sense. And this is the type of person that I was trying to protect my young people from, and yet he was sitting right in front of me asking for my help. So this did just challenge my faith, because we're meant to be welcome with everybody. This is something I didn't want to do. But the more I got to know him, the more I heard his story, and the more I started to realize how he got to where he was. And it's not my place to say why it was, but this is the life he'd always known, right? His dad wasn't around, and his stepdad was abusive. And so this is the life he always No, and so I started to feel really compassionate for him. We actually became really good friends, and I started to share my story and open up my life to him. And then one day when I was dropping him off at his house, his home life was a bit crazy, and I don't know where it came from, because as soon as I said it, you know when you say something and you wish you could just grab the words back and eat them, right? I was like, just come and stay with me. And I'm that guy. And he said to me, he goes, you should probably go back and talk to your wife first. And I was like, you've probably just saved my marriage, and he probably did. And so I went back to my wife, and if we're honest, none of us really wanted to come and stay. You know, and there was two reasons why, and I'm gonna be brutally honest here. One, we did not want this massive inconvenience to interrupt our comfortable Christian lifestyle. And two, I was scared in case he stole my stuff. I was scared in case he stole my PlayStation. I'm 32 and I love playing my PlayStation. And I was scared in case he stole my car, because that's what he was known for, right? So we sensed our conviction and we decided he'd come and stay. And he didn't stay that long. He stayed for a week, right? But when he stayed, it really opened our eyes to what to how we have missed the mark when reaching the marginalised. And this guy, you know, sit with him night after night as he came off drugs, during his withdrawals, as his mind fell apart, I really started to understand how not only me and my church have missed the mark when reaching these people. And so I constantly invited him, about a week, and then he went back to his life. But we became friends, and we were still friends 4 years later. And I became his next of kin somehow, right? And that means with every attempt on his life, with every attempt at his own life, with every hospital administration, with everything that went wrong in his life, I was contacted. And so I used to constantly ask myself whether it was actually worth it, because it was a massive pain in my neck, right? It was a massive, like, hindrance to my life. At one point, 3 o'clock phone calls in the morning, hospital visits to the addiction ward, to Bluestone. But, you know, even though he has his ups and downs, he was homeless for a while. 4 years later, he's clean on drugs. He's clean off drugs, right? And he's got himself a flat, and he's starting to rebuild his life. And he's never accepted Jesus, right? And I don't know if he ever will. But when I asked him, you know, what was it that really helped you to change? Because we openly talk about God. I've told him the gospel countless times. So it's up to him and God whether that actually happens, right? And he says, I don't remember any sermons. I don't even remember a service, but I remember the people who showed up and who sat with me in my pain and my mess. Get emotional, but I didn't write that down. Johnny, I promise, right? And he rang me 2 weeks later, 2 weeks ago, and said, I've still got that Bible church got me when I was in hospital, and I feel it calling out to me, saying I need salvation. So he's close, but this is the thing, right? This is the bit that really gets me, is that through my work with Youth for Christ, I now work with one of his kids, right, who's going into fourth year. And he became a Christian. And it's crazy, right? Yeah. And so we look at the cycle of what breaks that cycle of abuse and trauma, and it's Jesus, right? But it's not the middle class Jesus, it's the radical Jesus. And so the only way this was possible, the only way his son became a Christian was for a reluctant willingness to get out of my comfort zone. And so this was not a radical act, but an act of obedience to the call to live out the principles of the kingdom in our everyday. And so I want to just go on to the next bit here, and it's looking at what's our mandate? What's our Christian mandate? And I think it's simply a call to care. We say things weird in Kirkavan, right? So forgive me. Don't ask me to talk about beef, because I'll say it really weirdly, right? Steak, anyway. So we're going to start in Exodus. We're going to cover 4,000 years in 2 minutes, maybe three, right? So you all know the story, right? Moses leads the people by Exodus, the big liberation of Israel. One of the verses that really gets me and gets captures the heart of God in this is Exodus 3:7. And you all know this, right? So I'm preaching to the choir here. The Lord said, I've surely heard and see, I've surely seen the afflictions of my people who are in Egypt, and I've heard their cries because of their taskmasters. I know their suffering. Not only did God hear their struggle, but he knew the pain of their oppression, right? And you know how the story goes. Moses leads them into the wilderness, and he has a lot of work to do to get them ready for the promised land. 40 years of work. Should have been 40 days, 40 years. That's if you sign a contract, rip that thing up, don't you? And one of the ways in which Israel were meant to represent their God was how they cared for the disadvantaged. In Leviticus 19, we see God give Moses the instructions of how the Israelites are meant to live out the holiness of the Lord. And out of 37 verses, right, it mentions 15 times that I am the Lord your God. God gives Moses an instruction, but after every instruction, he reminds him that he is the Lord their God. And so 15 reminders of how they were meant to represent God and how they were meant to respond to their ways. And so they were meant to respond in a few ways. Firstly, to hold everything they had with an open hand. Okay, do not be tight-fisted to the poor. Secondly, the generous treatment of a stranger. They were meant to welcome strangers and foreigners as citizens into God's community. And lastly, they were meant to, in everything they did, they were meant to represent the Lord. This is a non-negotiable. Everything you do, you represent me. I am the Lord your God. So we move into the New Testament, right? Jesus enters the story. God in the flesh, everything God has to say to us in a person, yeah? You all know the visible image of the invisible God, the fulfillment of the law. And like the Israelites, Jesus' story starts in oppression, right? He's on the run. And it's quite ironic that he actually flees. He fled to Egypt until it was safe to return to Bethlehem. But just like in Exodus, right, Jesus embodied God, embodies God by feeling the struggle of his people. But he didn't just feel it. He came and dwelt among them. Jesus' ministry of salvation was one that opposed the religious and the rich and the proud, and by elevating the poor, which included the widows and the orphans, but also now there's a greater emphasis on the rejected, the crippled, the lame, the deaf, the blind, the sick, and now the stranger, who are now the Gentiles. Basically, anyone who was rejected by the religious elite, Jesus lifted up. Rejected, not only, they weren't rejected by God, but they were rejected by the people who were meant to represent God. Those in the margins had one thing in common, and that was poverty. The situation thrusted them into a life of poverty, pushing them further into the margins. So marginalization and poverty go hand in hand. Rich people don't get marginalized. It doesn't happen. It's the poor, because they're easily exploited. So we see Jesus constantly coming up against these groups when he's interacting with the marginalized, as well as other rejected people groups. So the tax collector, the prostitute, the demon-possessed, the women, and all other sinners. Jesus' biggest barrier in reaching the marginalized was the religious. And ultimately, they ordered his execution. Why? Why did the religious people who were waiting on the Messiah ordered the Messiah's execution? Because he made them uncomfortable. He challenged their passiveness towards those in the margins, and he called them out as they had missed the mark of representing their God. They had forgotten who they were. Jesus calls us not only to serve with the poor, but to identify with them. Let's go back to Moses, right? Moses only left privilege when he had to. He didn't choose to. He killed the guy and was going to have to go on the run. So even though Moses identified as an Israelite, he didn't dwell among them. Yeah? Jesus turns out on his head. Jesus says, I don't only feel your pain. I will dwell among you and I will come among you. So Jesus, not only did he identify with the poor, but he actually got up close and personal with their need. He never shied away from those in the margins, and he never hesitated to speak against the systems that oppressed them. Moses, even though he was trying to identify with the Israelites, he was still part of the system that oppressed them. And so that's a challenge for us. How are we meant to reach those on the margins whenever we still gain from the systems that oppress them? And so he based his entire ministry on lifting up the poor from the margins. And we as Christ followers should do the same. So there's a problem, though, and I'm going to address some of these problems. I'm going to address two, and then Johnny will come up and address one of them. The marginalized are not well represented in our churches. And I think most of us would agree with this statement. We have people in the margins who use our services, so our food banks, our parent and toddler groups, our language classes, our youth groups, our drop-ins, our community outreach programs. But let's be honest, they don't actually have to come to our church to avail of these, right? And actually, there are some secular organizations that do it better than we do. But I'm not here to talk about bums and seats, right? I'm not here to talk about just getting people to say a prayer, getting them over this line that we have created. Church family is important. Being part of a church body is crucial for a Christian's life. But also welcoming in the marginalized as brothers and sisters instead of a charity case. We need people in the church who are willing to put their arm around the poor and the marginalized and walk with them through the really hard journeys. People who are willing to lay down their contentment and comfort in order to see others experience the kingdom of God. The marginalized don't need a service. They need a family. Their desire is to be more than just statistics and mice to feed. Their desire is to be in community. From my experience, and you can take it or leave it, people in the marginalized feel like they can't be part of the church because they feel like they're just another charity case, which just brings guilt and shame upon them. That's not our intention, obviously, but that's what happens in our culture. People on the margins find it really difficult to be part of the faith community. So why is this? And so we go back to the example of my friend, right? What took him so long to come to church is because he didn't have good shoes. That was it. It wasn't the fact he didn't want to. He really wanted to come to church. He really wanted to explore more of this person, Jesus, but he didn't have any good shoes. And this seems to be, this is probably one of the reasons I first brought to church. I preached in my sweats and trainers to show that it didn't matter. It just didn't matter what you were, come as you are, and not as you should be. But this might sound slightly ridiculous, but having a Sunday best is actually a barrier to the poor not coming to church, because they don't look like everyone else. Yeah, they don't look like us. And so when they come in Caravan, it's usually tracksuits and other, you know, tracksuits are quite expensive, but they've probably had them for about 20 years. But the Sunday best is a massive barrier for them. And the reality is, and I've been part of the church for 12, 13 years, right? We are really good at giving off the impression that we have it all figured out. We're actually really good at actually coming across that we are better than we are. And that is really, really intimidating for the marginalized. And let's go on to education really, really quickly, right? There's a small-scale study in the UK in 2017 that recorded some findings that I think help paint us a picture, right? So it's found that 81% of adults in the UK church have a university degree or higher, right? So let's look at how we teach our services, right? Lecture type feel to it. You listen to a sermon from someone at the front. You look at a really good PowerPoint that Johnny done. And if you're really, really holy, you take notes, right? God's watching, like, God's watching. And this isn't bad. We see in our current culture, we need sound doctrine. In our current climate in the West, we need more sound doctrine than we've ever needed. But this is really hard for someone who struggles with education. And what I find with people who struggle in education are visual learners, right? And remember, Jesus was the word in action. And so have your sound doctrines, but if it's not backed up by action, it's just noise, yeah? Jesus was word and action. And so the people who struggle in education will learn best by seeing how you live out the gospel in your life. And so and this is one of the reasons why it's really hard for me and Caravan to bring them to church, because people actually, I think less than half of the kids in Caravan leave with 5 GCSEs. So forget your degree. If you're not getting GCSEs, you're really going to struggle in church. A commentator, Douglas Hall, says that the middle class culture in the West has desolated our view of the marginalized. He says our ministers and church leaders who have been educated within a middle class institution are surrounded by congregations with middle class presuppositions, and they lose touch of what it means to be marginalized and to be placed in a marginalized community, ultimately becoming more difficult, if not impossible, to be morally in tune with the social needs of our day. And so the lack of marginalized people in our churches has actually disconnected us from what it actually means to work with the marginalized. Pete Portal, who left a middle-class life and moved to South Africa to plant a church in Gang, Manenberg, says, vulnerable people don't need a slick ministry or a middle-class home group, they need a family. Aaron White says, poor people don't need shoes and food stamps, they need a place at your table for the next 25 years. At your table, not just the church, but your table in your house. And so this brings us to the lack of response, right? There is a gap between the church and the marginalized, and it's hard to admit, but it's a harsh reality that we as the body of Christ need to face. And please hear me on this. I am not saying that churches don't do amazing things to reach people in the community. They do, but it's not enough. The amount of churches in Northern Ireland, and there's only a handful, maybe a couple of handfuls, who are actually really doing the life-changing work in our communities. And this may seem, and the reality is that we need to reach people who are struggling to survive. Right, we know what we've all heard the statement of heating or eating, right? That's a reality for over 300,000 people in Northern Ireland. And so you may think it's an exaggeration. I'm saying to you, people's survivals rely on us. But if over 300,000 people are still living in poverty, imagine if one person from every church took at least one person home and fed them for a week. Imagine the impact that would have. With the current information about how the Northern Irish Church carries out mission, it seems that we are more concerned with overseas mission than the poor who are right in front of us. And the overseas mission is part of the Great Commission, but we're missing a vital component. Jesus said to his followers, go to Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. And so, but we are really good at going to the ends, but we miss out on Jerusalem, Judea, and Samaria. We miss them out. And the reason why is because it's easy. It's actually easier for us to give money for people to go to a different country. It's actually easier to send young people on a 2-week mission trip because it doesn't cost them anything bar a year fundraising, right? And I'm not dissing that. I've taken young people on countless mission trips, okay? I think they're really good at helping open the eyes of young people to a world out there. But it's not enough, and we're missing a massive component. Our overseas mission, our long-distance mission should be an overflow of how we love our own communities. I'm just going to skip on down here because I know I'm pretty tight for time, right? So unfortunately, we have become too comfortable and content with where we are as the church. We want to play it safe. We want to build our own empires and try to start in God's kingdom where it's convenient, instead of surrendering all of who we are to God's kingdom and basing our entire life around it. Pulling all our ideas and all our finances and our materials and our lives with an open hand to the Lord, but holding the ways of the kingdom with a tight fist and not letting go. God's kingdom is inconvenient and it should cost you. If God's kingdom isn't costing us, then are we following Jesus? Are we following Jesus? Because if it's not costing us, right, and these are statements you've all heard, then we are lukewarm. We're still on the fence. We aren't playing our part, and it means that we're missing out on what God has for us and for the people around us. And so the second, there's a practical example that I want to just quickly say. So the example, how to paint a picture of this, is that if someone comes to you who's hungry, the most convenient and comfortable thing to do is signpost them to a food bank, right? But the radical disciple of Jesus invites that person into their home for dinner. And if they have a family, invite them too. And then you walk the long walk with them. You build a relationship with them, take them by the hand, and walk them through what services they can go to. Walk them to the food bank. Show them how to do a shop, yeah? Build a relationship with them for the next 25 years if you need to see them back on their feet, and if they find Jesus in the midst of that, that's a bonus. And so the second option takes a lot more from us. It's more uncomfortable and it's hard, but these are the things of the kingdom. Johnny's going to cover the last one and then I'll come up and finish.
So how do we get there? How do we get there to some of the stuff that Johnny's talking about? Because maybe you're like me and thinking that feels like alien. That feels like something I don't know how I would start to do some of that. I think part of the problem is that we don't have relationships with people who are experiencing these things for many of us. It's true for me. I work with Johnny, and I'm so blessed by working with Johnny as he ministers to us and the staff team and shares with us. But I don't have the experiences that Johnny has. And actually, I'm sitting going, I don't have relationships with people in Northern Ireland who are living close by me who are experiencing these levels of disadvantage. I don't have that relationship. And if I don't have those relationships, it's really hard to start. So we need to put ourselves in those places to have it. And we think it's difficult. We think it's difficult because we think there's no common ground. We think we're so different than those people who maybe live on the housing estate or live a couple of hundred yards or a couple of miles away from us. But you'd be surprised as you get to know them, as you talk to them, the amount of commonality that we do have. All people made by God living here in Northern Ireland. We've got family, we've got friends. There's a lot of commonality, but we think that we don't have it. I was talking to one minister, and he said this, which really struck me, hurt me, and made me feel a bit uncomfortable. He didn't feel like his middle-class congregation would be able to relate to those in a working-class community. And he thought there would be little appreciation of their lives and a little desire to know and understand. I don't want that to be me. I don't want that to be the churches that I am part of, the churches that I represent. But it is difficult. Relationship is difficult. One of the things, the poverties that we talked about, was relational poverty. Because young people and their families and communities that are experiencing disadvantage often, they're struggling with relationships. They don't know how to maintain good relationships. They don't know how to foster those things. And actually, whenever you go and you try and build a relationship, the first thing that you're going to get is pushback. The first thing you're going to get is potentially hurt. Like the young people, that's the context that Johnny and I work in, is with young people primarily. And we have experienced pretty severe, challenging behavior. And the challenging behavior that I am talking about is physical and emotional abuse of staff, of volunteers, young people defecating in bins, misuse of fireworks, drug dealing, substance abuse, vandalism of property. You imagine opening your doors to those types of situations, experiencing that, and then having to pick up the pieces. One of our youth workers earlier on in the year went back the following day to the church that he was using with a piece of plasterboard and his saw to repair the wall that had been kicked through because we're going again and again and again, and it's going to cost us in trying to build those relationships. Relationships are key. You see it all through the New Testament, how relationships are key in mission. And we see it in the woman at the well. If we go back to the woman at the well, briefly, to Jesus' example, Johnny talked about a few things which might resonate with you as we think about what Jesus does with the woman at the well, because essentially he brokers a bit of an impossible relationship. He's a man at midday in the middle of the town where the well is, and this woman comes along by herself. Jesus breaks the social taboo by engaging her, by talking to her. It would have been normal, actually, for him to have stepped away from the well to show that actually it was safe for her to come and to draw. He breaks the social taboo by asking her for water, by asking her for help. He puts himself at her need. He's there by himself. His disciples are not there. It's not a fake request for water. It's midday in the heat, and he puts himself at her need. He elevates her, gives her an opportunity for her to bless him, to serve him. He engages her in conversation. He honors her questions. She actually sort of challenges him a wee bit. Again, maybe we don't notice the cultural sort of faux pas there, but the fact that she challenged him and said, who are you to ask me for water? And actually, he engages her in conversation. She talks to him about the well, and he talks about living water, and he honors her conversation about theology, and he has that conversation with her. He's constantly elevating who she is as a woman who's been divorced 5 times, who finds that the only time that she can come to draw water is in the middle of the day by herself, that he puts himself at her need. He talks to her. He engages her in conversation. He honors her questions and interactions with her. And he builds this relationship. Jesus didn't just, as Johnny was saying, he didn't just teach these things to his disciples and tell them to go. He modeled it. He modeled it all the time through all his interactions. And if we look closely at what he's doing, if we look closely beyond the surface, like, that story is an amazing story of a Samaritan woman who realizes who Jesus is. And for many of us, it's the story where we see that Jesus shows that his kingdom is not just for the Jews. And the story is about that. But also we see something really special about how Jesus interacts with those who are marginalized. I think our churches need to change. The mission officer in PCI had this to say about church. He said, for the unchurched, a service of worship is likely to be a new experience in a strange building amongst unfamiliar people to hear a mysterious message. I wonder, do we think about our church? Do we think about this sort of gathering? Like, can you imagine inviting somebody along to this who'd never experienced it? How much we take for granted about how we know how things work. Does our church culture appear synonymous with things of middle-class culture? Our enjoyment of coffee, our trips to the seaside, how we talk about things that we do, the examples that we use. Johnny's talked about the teaching style that we have. What about the unwritten rules of church? When we stand up, when we sit down, what we do, when we ask questions, when we don't. Do we help people understand how they can engage in church? Or are we creating a place where the appropriate behavior is more important than belonging to this community, this family that we have? I heard a fellow preaching, and he was talking to people who had recently come to Northern Ireland, and their comment on our culture was, our church culture as well, was, it's kind of superficially welcoming. Like, we're really good at saying hello and getting people involved and starting, but actually we draw a line of how far we're prepared to go and what people actually need. There's a cultural distance between many of us, and I put my hands up and say that I have this cultural distance between many people who are experiencing disadvantage, and I want to be part of the change. I want to see us change as individuals and change as churches to be places that are more welcoming to people who are experiencing disadvantage. Johnny, let me change us.
Here, Johnny, take that there, will you? I don't want to break it. I break things, remember? So I'm just going to... I'll start with a story and I'll finish with one. I'll finish with my own, and then just a few things I need to say, and then we'll have time for questions. So I spent the first 15 years of my life in and out of poverty. And for most of my childhood, I watched my parents struggle. And now, the poverty, people have different reasons why they're thrusted into poverty. My dad was owning the company. The company went down. And my mum was sick. And so all that put us in poverty. And me and my brothers, all my brothers, and four brothers, we all struggled in education. Right? My mum was a Christian and brought us up in church. And she brought us up in a really amazing church, right? Which my family, some of my brothers, and my mum still go to. But at the time, when we were that age, as kids who were struggling in education, we just felt like we didn't fit the mold. Right? We had a Sunday best, but it was one set of clothes. And if you ruined them, you were in trouble because they were your Sunday best. And so by the time I was 19, with all that struggle, I was a drug addict. And I don't blame the church, by the way. I didn't tell you about this amazing church to blame them. Like, God didn't give me drugs. But my drug addiction was a feeling of not fitting in, right? Of constantly being written off by society and education. And so my drug addiction was through my own choices, okay? I'm not going to blame anyone else but myself. I found Jesus at 19, right? And this journey of searching actually started when I was 13, 6 years before this. I met a Christian youth worker who said one statement, right, that changed my life forever. He said, "There's more to you than you'll ever know." But that what made this line was so powerful that it was backed up with action. He didn't just see me as a project or a charity case. He saw me as a trophy of God's grace. He invited me into his life. Every week, he invited me and my friends into his family home to tell us the gospel. Johnny shared a story about one of our youth workers whose young people racked the church. We racked his home. Every week, he invited us back, and he told us the gospel. And his mum was very middle class and house proud, so it didn't really bode well. But... And so he showed up at my darkest hours as a teenager. He was there to pick up the pieces of my own mistakes. And he invited me into a Christian community where I was actually accepted as I was. I could come in my tracksuit and no one batted an eyelid. And I remember the first time going to this church and this heavy hand fell on my shoulder. And it was a guy, you probably know him, Phil Emerson, pastor of Emmanuel in Lurgan. And he's like, "Welcome home, son." First time I met him. And so I felt at home. Obviously, it didn't really stop me from engaging in some of the behavior I was engaging in. But when I hit rock bottom, right, this guy was there to lift my head towards Jesus. And so 6 years of trailing through the mud and the pain and the struggle of a disadvantaged kid that he met in the park. But it didn't end there. He helped me get clean. He helped me recognize my gift in working with young people. He helped me. He took a risk on me and became my line manager and took me in as an intern. He pulled all the stops and the strings to get me into university, even though I had no education. He's my daughter's grandfather, or godfather, grandfather, that'd be weird. And he's still a voice of reason in my life today. Almost 20 years later, he's still a consistent voice in my life. And this is the kingdom relationship that we are talking about. This is what it means to evangelize. It is not preaching at street corners, hoping someone catches it. That's worked for some people, but that's not the model anymore. It needs to take lifelong commitment in relationship. This is what it looks like to undo the ills of society. And this is one life at a time, and this is what Christian mission looks like. It was never a service or a sermon. And I went to Emmanuel, and we had great preachers growing up, right? And I've seen some great speakers and there's been some great services, but I don't remember any of them really, right? I remember one or two lines that really stuck in my head. But for someone who struggled in education, that wasn't my strong point. But I remember the people and the Christians who sat in my pain. I remember the people and the Christians who picked me up after a relapse. I remember the people and the Christians who brought me into their home and invited me in for dinner. And I know that all this stuff, right, is easier said than done. It brings up loads of questions of inviting people and strangers into your home. Like, what are the barriers? Yeah? What are the risks of inviting a criminal into your home? Where do you draw the line? Like, when is enough enough? Like, when do you say to that person, I can't be a part of your life anymore because of two dangers? Which I've had to do to some people, okay? These are all really good questions. And the reality is there is no right answer. You're not going to get a right answer from me or Johnny or from the people who write the best books because we all have different capacities, right? Some people, Rebecca who works for me, Rebecca Fahey who works for me in Craigavon, she has a friend in Dublin who just invites everybody into her house. She'll meet people that day and invite them for dinner and to stay and give them a bed, right? That's really, really good. I'm a massive introvert. I'd burn out in an hour, you know what I mean? So for me, it's I have a handful of people who I'm journeying with. It could be just one person. It could be just one family. But this is the bit that really hits me the most. Whenever I was preparing this, I realized something, that Jesus had to look in the margins to the people in whom the religious rejected to find his group of unqualified disciples to become forefathers of the church. The people who planted our church with their blood were marginalized. And so by us not inviting the marginalized into our home, into our community, into our life, we are missing potential changers of the world, literally. And so what this shows is, and this is probably going to take a bit of pressure off you if you're feeling really, really heavy, right? It's actually not our job to reach everyone in the margins, right? It's not our job. Rather, it is our job just to reach one person from marginalized community with the good news, demonstrate the kingdom to them in radical hospitality, and be committed to a genuine relationship to go as far and as long as it takes for them to understand who they are in Christ and for the kingdom of God to take hold of their hearts, because it's them, people, who will change our societies. I told you about my friend at the start. I remember we'd done this crazy fundraiser. We do weird fundraisers at WFC, but we decided that we would run the Black Pass in Craigavon, which is like, Craigavon's built a motorway. It wasn't very well designed. So all the estates are connected by these Black Passes, about 3-4 miles long. We decided that we would run them at 5 o'clock every morning and pray one month, and it was horrific. But you know, we raised loads of money and God done loads of good things, but it was very tiring getting up at 4:30. But I remember we used to sit and pray at the bridge beside Craigavon Presbyterian, and we used to pray for this estate called Clawmain, and we used to say, God, rise up someone in that estate who will take the gospel to places that we could only dream of, right? Because we couldn't. And that estate was renowned for being places where there was drug dealers, weapon houses, like you name it, this estate had it, right? And so about a year later, and I just met my friend, and I rang him one day and I was like, you know, what done it for you? Like, why did you decide to contact the police out of all people and change your life? And this guy lives in that estate that we prayed for. And he says, one day in March 2019, whenever we were doing our fundraiser and praying on that bridge, he says, I woke up one day with a desire to change. This life, he had done 20 years of organized crime and taking drugs. And he woke up one day because people were praying on a bridge at stupid o'clock in the morning. And decided to change his life. And it's they're the people, they're the ones that we need to reach, because they're the ones that would actually change our societies. And I suppose the one line I'll leave you with is that it's better to respond to one than to none at all. One person. And if you don't know any, right, it's really because, you know, you know, if we're not used to mixing with people different to us, it's hard to get out there. There are so many organizations that are doing it, and this is a shameless plug, but we need volunteers. So if you want to come and volunteer for Youth for Christ, feel free to come and see the stall. But we have time for questions now, don't we? Yeah.
I suppose what we would like to do is just to give you 30 seconds, just to have a wee think, and maybe chat to the person beside you if you want. If there is a question, just to give an opportunity to process it. I see a question already, but I'm going to give people the 20 seconds, and then we'll go to you first, okay?
So I'm just want to thank your colleague for testimony. Very powerful. The church is, by and large, very middle class, very neglectful of its duty of care for the poor and the vulnerable, I'm afraid. I've done some research. I'm an old man. I've done some research into preachers, how they preach on subjects such as this, and most of them, the Church of Ireland, I'm not getting at anyone in particular, I am Church of Ireland, always have been, always probably will be, sadly. But anyway, anyway, that's besides the point. The point I'm trying to make, the ministers who do get a chance to the people that won't be in church, perhaps anyway, won't speak about subjects like this. 25% would never speak a sermon, even though they'll talk about this particular passage. They'll never raise these issues. And in America, it's only just changing. The younger breed of pastors are raising the issue. And thank God they are, because the young men, the young women on the streets are in living in poverty on our estates. They need to hear it, whether they're Catholic or Protestant or Jew or Buddhist. Thank you, brother.
Thank you. Thank you. Folks, if there is any questions, we're happy to take them.
Hiya. You've kind of answered my question already, but I just want to say, like, when I first got saved about 8 years ago, I came from a really, really bad place, and the church was exactly how you said it was, and they prejudged me. They were like, you know, what's this woman doing here? She's got two kids, no husband, and I was going through a divorce, and I nearly conformed to the church. And I heard God clearly speak to me and say, do not do that, because you need to be the change in that church. And the question I was going to ask is, how do I continue to be that change and reach people when I've got children? Like, I invited somebody into my house a while ago, and unfortunately they started drinking in the house and things. And like, I want to be that change, but I want to keep my children safe at the same time and also be a witness to my children. So
yeah, I've got two kids, so I feel your pain. Not because two kids are hard, well they are, but they're both toddlers. But yeah, so when I invited my friend into my house, I had no kids, so it was a bit different. Your most important ministry is your family, right? And some barriers I put in place, right, is I'll just use the example of my friend, because it's the one we've been talking about. When I had my second child, my son, I rang him and decided that it wasn't going to be his next of kin anymore. And I was very clear. I was like, you understand, my family are the most important thing to me. We are still really good friends. I'm still your support structure. You still come around for dinner, all that sort of stuff. But I can't be the person, the police in the hospital ring whenever you're in trouble anymore, because I've got a duty of care. But then there's a degree of guilt that comes with that, isn't there? So you feel this degree of guilt. It's like, I should be doing more, but my hands are tied. Just enjoy that place. Like, you know, you can do, yeah, I'm telling you now, just enjoy that place, because don't be afraid to have these people in the house around for dinner, but just know that there's limitations. So when you invite, so whenever my friend came to stay with us, my wife, who had never met him until he came to stay, right, sat him down like a child and says, any drinking, any drugs, the police call around, I find any weapons, I ring the police myself, you're right, all that sort of stuff. So, like, I would say, if you're inviting someone into your home, lay down the ground rules. Like, they're coming into your home, your Christian home. And so, like, one of the ground rules is that you can't swear in my house. You swear in my house, you're out the door. Because if my daughter says one of them words in school, then I'm in trouble, you know? So, boundaries, like, and you will figure it out as you go along. But I think one thing in all that, I hope that made sense, is that don't give in to feeling guilty. Don't make rash decisions because of how guilty you feel. Bring it to the Lord in prayer. Wait. Fast about it, whatever you need to do, and I'm like, you know, God values the family more than we'll ever know. And so I think they're your priority, and just like, in the most generic Christian answer I can think of, seek him, you know.
Just one other thing to add to that as well is, we're not meant to do this alone. Like, we do this as churches together. I heard an amazing story of a church where actually they collectively have responded to the need of children who need emergency foster care, but they do it together as a church, so that actually somebody says, I'll take the child, and then there's a whole lot of other people who get on board with the food and the things that are needed. So actually, as a church, as your local church families, we need to say, if you've got a heart for it, get other people around you who want to be involved in it too.
Just keep reminding me of stuff. So anyone, our church has quite a few of these people that I've talked about. And when he says about doing it together, I'm this person that's being put in contact, but I also have two other people who are my backup in church. Right. So for example, my wife's 30th birthday a few years ago, he went off on one, police were chasing him, people were worried for his life, and I was at my wife's 30th birthday party. And I was getting phone calls and stuff, and I just rang one of these guys. I was like, here, could you deal with this? I can't. Also, there's someone in your church who might have a spare room with no kids, you know, and, you know, that's the importance of finding people with a similar vision and heart to you, that it just makes it easier. Because if you do it by yourself, you get burnt out. These people, as much as we want to love them, they can drain you. Vulnerable people will drain you as much as you love them. And so I think that's really key. I think community is probably the biggest, is your biggest asset.
Yeah, we have another question.
Can you hear me? All right.
So coming alongside a family where there's children and you've got children?
I've got two boys, yeah. Our two boys met when they were 2 weeks old.
Okay.
So I've known her for a very long time, but the husband left. Very messy.
Yeah.
Very hard. And one of the boys is heading in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
Keen to intervene.
Do you want me to go? I think Johnny and I are not claiming to be experts in every situation. And if there's stories people want to chat about or situations, like do come and chat to us. In that sort of specific example, I think the fact that you have a relationship with the family is amazing, and it's just figuring out how you foster that and journey together. My wife and I, we are friends with people who aren't Christians, and we're journeying with them, and we're figuring out, well, what's that going to look like for us as a family, as children get older, and as they're involved in different things. And it's just one step at a time, and preserving the relationship. I think one of the things that we've really noticed is that God at the moment is using relationships to draw people to him, and fostering that relationship, keeping people close to you, even if they have no interest in hearing what you want to say about Jesus, but walking with them in that, walking with them as they grow up with their children, spending time together. And if there's concerns over boundaries, maybe come and have a wee chat. Okay.
I'm very conscious of time. Does anybody have one last question? Okay. Johnny and Johnny, I'm going to speak for you and say that they will be here for a while. but if you have children or anyone that you need to go pick up, please feel free to head on. I just want to thank Johnny and Johnny for everything that they have said. And really ask that you would reflect on what has been said and not just conform, but to really start to go home and speak to your ministers, speak to your friends, and sort of think through, what do we need to change?
Thank you for listening to this talk. If you would like to know more about New Horizon, please visit our website at newhorizon.org.uk.